All right, we have a pretty good group here, so I think we can get started. Can everyone hear me okay? Do I need to use the microphone? Okay. So I'm Mike Pisker with the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Governors and Premiers. Thanks everyone for taking the time this morning to come out. Me giving a briefing here on efficiently funding the SULAC. So we have a series of speakers. I'm going to start it off just with some of the kind of regional context, a bit about our organization, and then hand it off to my colleagues. So just quickly, Great Lakes St. Lawrence Governors and Premiers is a partnership of the 8 Great Lakes states and the 2 provinces, Canadian provinces of Ontario and Quebec, working together to grow the region's economy and protect the region's environment. Governor Evers of Wisconsin is our chairman, and Governor DeWine of Ohio is our vice chair. And the organization has been around for approximately 30 years, starting as the Council of Great Lakes Governors, working on a portfolio of projects, regional economic development, water management, things of that nature. And more recently, beginning in 2013, maritime transportation. So it really started from the idea of looking at maritime as a backbone of the region's $6 trillion economy, and thinking about how to take this important but underutilized asset and get more from it as an economic driver, a job creator for the region. So, you know, looking at this map, it kind of paints a good picture of the ports, not sort of a disparate network of ports, but everything interrelated around the lakes, connected to other modes of transportation, extending some 2,000 plus miles from Duluth, Minnesota in the west, all the way up the St. Lawrence River in the east. So the organization spent about a year developing a maritime strategy for the region, released in June of 2016, and this was developed with a broad range of partners in the region, so states and provinces, shippers, ports, NGOs, things of that nature, and with coming up with the goals of doubling maritime trade, shrinking the environmental impact of transportation, and supporting the region's industrial core. And we'll hear a lot more about that in the context of the SULACs, the importance to industry. As I mentioned, a kind of collaborative process, and in the end came up with about 30 recommended actions, policies, projects, and programs, some things that the federal governments in both countries can do, some things the states and provinces can do, some things that industry can do, again, all towards the goal of growing the economy and creating jobs based around maritime transportation. So in the 5 years or so that the initiative has existed, there's been really tremendous progress. Final congressional authorization for a new SULAC. We've launched a cruising promotion program called Cruise the Great Lakes, which is really geared at bringing more cruise passengers to the Great Lakes region. Worked with CBP to develop a network of 4 ports where passengers can be cleared, based off of really trying to have some predictability for a growing industry. We developed a Smart Ships Initiative, which right now is kind of focused on smaller research vessels, but looking at some of these emerging technologies as it helps to improve safety and efficiency of maritime. And then we've convened a series of maritime days. The first one was here in Washington. We actually did a briefing in the, I think across the hall, December of 2017. The next year in Ottawa, Ontario, met with a lot of governmental representatives there. And this is the most recent iteration of that. So these are our broad focus areas right now, a lot of which I just touched on. Growing markets, it's cruising, it's international trade, which primarily is taking place between the Great Lakes, St. Lawrence region, and Western Europe, particularly via the port of Antwerp in Belgium. On federal priorities, it's the SULACs, of course, it's pilotage, investing in infrastructure, lots of infrastructure needs throughout the Great Lakes system. It's an aging system. Right now, we're focused primarily on the SULACs, but there definitely are other things that will require attention in the months and years to come. And then smart ships, as I mentioned, and then blue accounting is a system for sort of tracking movement through the system and the value of cargo and things like that. So SULACs, which is why we're all here today, really is the linchpin of the regional maritime system. This graphic here in the upper right, you can see, shows sort of the heat map of traffic. So using my pointer here, this is the SULACs. You can see that's really sort of the single gateway between Lake Superior and the rest of the system. As you'll see on the next slide and slides to come, it shows the flow of raw materials coming out of, we'll just go to it. So you see here, coming out of Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, all of those ships have to transit through the Sulax to make it to steel production facilities and manufacturing facilities in Indiana, in Ohio, and Michigan, and elsewhere. So really, the Army Corps of Engineers calls it the potential single point of failure in the regional maritime system, and as we'll hear in some of the future slides, in the sort of national economy as well. So just quickly, in the project itself, the original locks were constructed in 1943 and 1968, respectively. So these are the two locks that are still operational. Getting old infrastructure. A second Poe-sized lock, which is the current project, was originally authorized in 1986. 2007, the Army Corps was directed to build it at full federal expense. In 2016, there was a report from the Department of Homeland Security, which we'll talk about in the next section, talking about some of the potential impact of a closure of the Sulax, the importance to industry in the region, and really the nation. Of course, this was reauthorized just last year. And then in 2019, we had a letter from the Great Lakes governors to Congress supporting full federal funding for a new Sulax. So that is sort of where we're at now in terms of the process. And that's the background. What I'd like to do now is introduce my colleague, Ben Takoda. He is the Chief Executive Officer of the Ports of Indiana. He's going to talk a bit about the regional importance and importance for the state of Indiana.
Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, everybody's awake. That's good. My name is Vaught Takoda. I'm the CEO of the Ports of Indiana. 2 years ago, I was the Executive Director, CEO of the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. My career has booked in this issue, right? In recent. Oh, man. No.
Down. Got to push down to go forward.
This is upside down, then.
That's fine.
It gave me the
other way.
The pointer.
Oh no, that's right. That's right.
That's it.
You changed this on me. Alright, well I'm just gonna do my thing there. I'm here to tell you about the why. Why is this so important? Because of the value of what we have. This is the single greatest supply value chain in the steel industry, and I would argue within North America. This value chain starts with a molecule up in Michigan and the Iron Range. It is started with a manufacturing process to make a pellet called taconite. That pellet, as it moves through the system down to Duluth or into Michigan across the Sioux, down into the lower lakes, is then further value added. Right now, my current responsibility puts me right in the heart of steel production. 25% of the nation's steel is produced in Northwest Indiana. We are at the heart of it. My port in Burns Harbor is a steel campus. It is the largest process that we do. That molecule literally goes through ArcelorMittal, U.S. Steel, and comes to us in the form of a rolled product in which further value add is distributed within our ports. That molecule then goes, I'll use our own state, into Toyota, downstate, where it becomes a Toyota Sienna, which brought me here today. I drove my Toyota Sienna here. In our state, Subaru is a manufacturer that just produced its millionth vehicle within the United States. The only other Subaru plant in the world that producing these vehicles is in Japan. They only have one manufacturing. And it's because of this supply chain that they're able to do this. $1.3 trillion of economic impact. That's the gross domestic product that would be lost to a failure of the Sioux for 6 months. A 6 month outage, 11 million jobs. Now, I've been challenged before on this number. And the question comes in the form of, do you really believe it? 11 million jobs. I shrug my shoulders and I say, what if they're wrong? What if they're half wrong, right? We're talking about 5.5, 6 million jobs, 8 million jobs. Where's the number that you start to become comfortable in an economic downturn? Considering, and somebody in here, because you guys are a really smart group, is going to correct me. If we go back 08, 09, what did that look like? It was between 8 million and 9 million, am I right? I see some heads, okay, so that's good, right? So let's go back to that. Who wants to go back to that economic impact? I don't think we do. The value of this process and this supply chain has served this nation for decades. And my what I say about our infrastructure, great infrastructure serves in silence. And that's what this has done for years upon years. This is, Tom's going to correct me on this. I would say this lock system is now 40 years out of its normal redevelopment cycle.
I'll give you that.
All right. I'm doing pretty good today, right? why can't this just be duplicated, right? We're talking about, Tom represents a group of ship owners. These ships are majority 1,000 footers. That doesn't sound like a lot. Now take 6.5 unit trains, put them end to end. That's what we're moving. And these guys move it round trip from, we'll say, Duluth, Minnesota, down to Burns Harbor. Round trip, 6 days. That's loading, unloading. It's a magnificent piece of engineering. It's a magnificent piece of manufacturing, and it's been honed over decades. And it's just gotten bigger and better. You stop that literally with auto manufacturing, just-in-time delivery, you're talking about weeks before it starts to choke the automotive sector. Michigan, Indiana are going to be the first ones that are hit. In our region, we've got 6 manufacturers of automobiles that we supply to. Almost every one of our manufacturing base is somehow tied to the automotive industry. Indiana, per capita, is the number one manufacturing employment state, per capita. The next biggest is California. So think of that in terms of a comparison. And so this is the wave of the interaction that will happen. So if your state has anything to do with the automotive industry, as an original equipment manufacturer, as a seller of vehicles, as a user of vehicles, the impact becomes concentric from the Midwest. This is the unemployment rates. Obviously, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Wisconsin, if you took those states alone, they're top 5 manufacturing states. Immediately, it's going to hit in those areas. And that's for those who don't like pictures. I really think that's all I had to say. That was all of my task, right?
That's it.
All right, good. I've got Larry. I hope I didn't steal too much.
Not at all. Thank you. Hello, I'm Larry Carnes, Michigan Department of Transportation. It says Freight Policy Specialist, but I've really been our department's primary marine transportation source for many years. We won't say how many. But I'd like to focus in a little bit more just on Michigan and the impacts on Michigan of the Sioux Locks. And while my comments are focused on Michigan, they apply in varying degrees to all the states in the region. Just a quick look at what commodities are actually passing through Michigan that use Michigan ports in addition to passing through the Sioux Locks. They tend to be bulk commodities, iron ore, coal, stone, and cement. That makes up the majority of the traffic, although there are other manufactured goods as well, again, serving Michigan ports. While these commodities are of considerable value themselves, the real issue is the industries that depend upon those commodities. So the iron ore going into the steel mills, the coal going into various industries and electric utilities, stone for construction all over the region. So both Vanta and Mike talked about that Department of Homeland Security study back in 2015, gave some overviews nationwide, and every state in the union would be affected by a closure of the PO. And the reason that's important, not only if there was for an accident or whatever reason that the PO might be out of service for 6 months, one of the bullets on the earlier slides we didn't really focus on was that to do a complete and necessary rehabilitation of the PO lock would require its closing for 6 to 12 months. And so even without an emergency situation, eventually the PO has to be updated. So this is focusing on what happens to the Michigan economy. As Vanta said, the steel industry takes a huge hit. I'm not going to read through all of the bullets, but in Michigan alone, tremendous impact on our manufacturing industry, nearly a million jobs lost in Michigan alone. We would have the honor of having the highest unemployment rate in the country at nearly 23%, and almost $100 billion decrease in the state's gross domestic product, 20% decrease. For those of you who haven't seen that Homeland Security study, I would recommend it as reading. It's kind of a horror story in a way, and it really brings home the fact of the importance of this infrastructure. Sorry. So now, what's been Michigan's involvement? Well, clearly a new lock is of importance to all of the Great Lakes states and other states well beyond our region. Michigan's in a unique position because the lock is physically in Michigan. So the state government, multiple departments within state government have been working cooperatively with the Corps, going all the way back into the 1980s on the planning for a new lock, getting involved in the transportation and economic needs, looking at environmental impacts. And so we've been very closely involved. We've attended many meetings like this here in Washington and other locations around the region, talking to folks like you. Our state legislators and members of Congress have been very supportive and obviously have been successful in now getting the project authorized at full federal funding and starting the flow of federal monies. Michigan, in an attempt to advance the project, contributed $52 million to the Corps last December. This was not a requirement. There's no cost-sharing requirement for the project, but we felt because of the importance to Michigan and the entire Great Lakes regional economy, it was important for us to put forward some money that would help the Corps move the project forward. And so that $52 million was transferred, and we worked very closely with the Detroit District of the Corps in monitoring and determining how that money will be spent, how the state money will be spent. But very briefly, about $37 million is expected to be used this year to complete the contracting process, to deepen the upstream approach channel, and to complete the design of the approach walls upstream, and then continue the design of the lock itself. And I won't go into the details of those. And then that leaves us with about $15 million that we're keeping in reserve, or the Corps is keeping in reserve, to spend as needed, to fill in where needed, again, to accelerate the project. The bottom line for Michigan, State of Michigan remains fully committed to supporting full federal funding for completion of the lock. And we will continue to work with the Corps, with our delegation, and others to make sure that happens. With that, I'll turn it over to Tom Rayburn from the Lake Carriers Association.
So I'm here for the ask, and these next 79 slides that we're going to go through will kind of wrap it up succinctly. I work for Lake Carriers Association. We're the primary stakeholder of the Sioux Locks. We're moving 90 million tons a year, 68 million tons of which we're moving the majority of it goes through the Sioux Locks every year. 90% of the iron ore that is moved, that is used for primary high-strength tensile steel is reliant on that Sioux Lock. It's reliant on, as Larry said, or Mike said, or Avanta said, maybe they all said, Michigan, UP Michigan taconite, as well as Minnesota taconite, okay? There's just no way around it. There's no alternate modes. We talked seven 100-unit trains to equal one of our vessels. 70,000 tons is what we're moving in each one of those 1,000-footers. We're actually the longest ships at the waterline for the entire U.S. fleet, including, I think, the new aircraft carriers. So these things are big. They're very efficient. We'll be moving those materials down. You're never going to see us unless you're a boat nerd and you're looking for us. We'll go into your town, we'll unload during the night, and we're back up, and you never even know we were there. We're also reliant on the Sioux Locks because we are moving 1 year's worth of goods in 9.5 months, because the Sioux Locks, by statute or regulation, actually has to close January 15th and then won't reopen until March 25th. So they need that time to do the work, whether it's major rehabilitation, whether it's normal maintenance that's going on. Because of that, we've actually been able to have a lock that's 51 years old, okay, without that major rehabilitation that is just starting now. So Army Corps of Engineers is doing yeoman's work to keep that thing going. But what we need to do is buy down that risk, and buying down that risk means this new lock, and it means efficiently funding this lock. So what we mean by the efficient funding is maxing out what the Corps can actually spend each year efficiently to move along that design work and that construction work. By efficiently funding this this work, the Corps figures they can save $30 million over the length of the project. They can reduce the overall time it takes for that construction. They can reduce it from potentially 10 years down to 7. Okay, and again, it's buying down that risk for the existing POE, which is going through that major rehabilitation. And we've got projects up there that I think could require as much as a six-month downtime for the actual POE to get work done on some of the components of that. So just to throw this in, that six-month time frame, that's that $1.3 trillion that Vonta was talking about. If it was down for that, that would be the hit to the U.S. economy. Now, Corps is looking at this as in three separate phases: upstream channel deepening, upstream approach walls, and then getting into the construction of the actual lock chamber itself. And they're all sequenced together so they can keep this thing moving. Right now, what we've got is we're finished up the design for the deepening. The contract is out. The RFP is out for the upstream deepening of that of the approach channel. That's going to be awarded later on, and then construction starts spring. Okay, construction will start spring. So that's the very first thing that needs to happen. That's a 2-year process. They've broken it into two different sections. Following, so that's 2020 and 2021. Following in 2020, they're going to set out the upstream approach wall RFP. So once the deepening is done on that first half of it, that's when they come in and do the approach walls for the second. So the approach walls are following on with that upstream with the upstream channel deepening. Once those two things are done, construction can start on that lock chamber itself. All these things have to be sequenced to go from that potential date down to that date for completion. Okay, so this is kind of what we were just talking about here, which is getting, you guys know what we're talking about, upstream channel and all that? Okay, what we're looking at right here is the downstream side of the Sioux Lock. That's Lake Superior. Down here is St. Mary's River that leads into Lake Huron. This is the MacArthur Lock. That was that was built during World War II. That can't fit many vessels anymore. Just a few of them. All the new vessels that are built to come in the Seaway won't fit through here. Okay. This is the Polock. That's the 1,000 foot. That's what we're relying on right now. These two were built 100 years ago. They've been mothballed. The new Sioux Lock, the new large lock, will fit in into the footprint that's sitting there right now. So not only do we have two 1,000 foot locks, we also have channel redundancy. So if anything happens, we've got a whole new way to get into those, into that lock itself. So here's what it is. Here's the ask. Right now, the money that has been put aside to start all this work is actually one, Michigan money, and two, work plan money, discretionary funds that were moved over by the Corps to start the work for 2019. There's not been that legislative budgetary line item at this point. However, right now what we have is the $75.3 million that was in the President's budget. The full House has passed that $75.3. Senate Appropriations has also passed that $75.3 million. But if everything goes through as right, we're still $48.5 million shy of the necessary amounts for efficient funding on the lock for 2020. There are discretionary funds, but we have to compete against those funds throughout the throughout all the national navigation projects, and that includes flood projects, port deepening along eastern Gulf Coast, some dam rehabilitations in California. There's a lot of people going for this discretionary funds. I don't know exactly how much it is, but it's typically been in that $300 to $400 million. So we're looking for a pretty big chunk. So the Great Lakes Congressional Task Force needs to raise their voice on this so we can get that. And then what we're looking for in these out years is full federal funding in the budget so we can keep moving along. If we don't keep moving along with this sufficient funding, we're going to have to start, stop, MOB, DMOB is going to kill us. It's happened on other locks throughout the nation. Olmsted, the guy that fixed the Olmsted is right over here, Mick Aubrey. But that one went double over budget. So how many years? 20 years to get completed?
It actually began in 1992.
Okay. So that was inefficient funding all across the board. We're looking to get this thing done in 7 to 8 years with that. So Corps already putting together their budget. This is the number they're going to put out there. That's the number we want, okay? 173.1. So I think that just tells exactly what we just said, okay? So efficient funding, efficient funding, efficient funding. We will talk at length about that. We'll talk at depth, but 48.5, we need the pressure to get on to get that money moved over for the discretionary core funds. 173.1 million is what we now need for 2021. Good? Cool. Back to you, Mike.